Urban Warriors is a program sponsored by the YMCA of Chicago that tries to steer teens away from gang involvement. It pairs neighborhood kids with military veterans. Abner Garcia was a 23-year-old Army vet who wanted to mentor kids who grew up in troubled neighborhoods like his. He told his story in this Urban Warriors audio archive.
My uncle, he came home and he was shot. And we had to take him to the hospital. I didn't know why he was shot. A rival gangbanger threw up his gang sign and he walked up to him, pulled out the gun right in front of him and shot him a lot of times. Yeah, that was my first time ever seeing that kind of stuff, you know, seeing someone hurt, seeing someone almost die in front of me, I guess you could say. I was about 5 years old.
A few months after that recording was made, Garcia was dead. He was shot after gang members he didn't know pulled up in a van alongside his car and opened fire. Garcia's death stunned his community and his coworkers at the Office of Youth Safety and Violence Prevention at the YMCA. Eddie Bocanegra heads that office. Like Garcia, he too had turned his back on gang life and now counsels young people. Bocanegra is struggling to find meaning in the face of a seemingly constant stream of tragedies.
The irony is that a Saturday morning, just about 3 hours after his passing, we were convening a training for our veterans, for about another 20 vets that were about to start the next group of Urban Warriors, and Abner was actually one of them. And, you know, we're getting text messages from our kids, and they're calling our phones, they're calling the staff's phones, and finally my staff are telling me, Eddie, you know, we're hearing rumors from the kids, and they want to know if it's true, and they're saying that Abner is dead. I told my staff, can you go into Abner's Facebook and see what are some of the comments that are being said? And sure enough, they look at the Facebook, and there people are posting rest in peace, you know, we're going to miss you, Abner, and so forth. Obviously, like anybody else, I was in disbelief, I didn't want to believe it, I just didn't understand, couldn't begin to fathom how or why. And the coverage that this story has received since then has been a very positive one, meaning it's received a lot of attention, and it's bringing some national attention to this problem that we have in Chicago, especially now that it's involving a United States veteran.
What would be the reason, after there was so much violence last year, there'd be even more violence this year? What is going on?
I think it's a couple of things that I would say behind it. The first, I would say that right now the Chicago Police Department, under so much scrutiny and pressure, that they are not being able to operate the way they would probably would in any given other year. Because of the mistrust between community and the police are being scrutinized in terms of their tactics, which often prevent officers to be able to execute on their work, to be able to detect something before it happens and approach it in a way they might have done in the past because of concerns of civil rights. As a result of that, people, adults, young people that we work with here, right, they're willing to take that risk now of walking around with a gun or driving around with a gun because the police are less likely to actually pull them over now. And I think it's important to actually acknowledge that. But on the flip side of that, I think it's also important to recognize the challenges the community actually faces as well. You know, in a nutshell, every time that a resident hears about police abuse, every time that you hear about a young person being shot or killed, it actually takes away the hope that many of these communities actually have. Where's hope behind all this? Because it doesn't seem like there's light at the end of the tunnel. It seems like every Monday morning, we pick up the paper to see how many shootings and homicides we actually had. That narrative, right, becomes old, but also becomes normalized. They need to have hope. The people who are being impacted by violence, shootings, and homicides, the victim survivors have to have some sort of hope, right? If I think of Admiral Garcia and his family, they have hope that they'll find the alleged killer behind this. They have hope that the friends and family and those that were allies to Abner will pick up the torch and find themselves in the trenches to kind of, you know, change this narrative and change this issue of violence in our city. And it starts with themselves. So I think it's about hope at the end of the day.
Your programs at the YMCA try to give people hope, Urban Warriors and some of the other things that you do. But it's just really a drop in the ocean, it seems. Do you see anything addressing this problem citywide, the macro issues?
I do. I mean, just right now, you have the foundation community here in Chicago. You have the MacArthur Foundation. You have the McCormick Foundation. You have the Joyce. You have these major foundations in the city of Chicago who are coming together and support some of the small nonprofit organizations and large ones to find ways to be able to address some of the violence in our city. And one of the ways they're doing this is by using research. And by that, I mean, they know, just as much as I know, that typically when school starts, violence typically increases, that homicides always spike around that time.
Why would that be? You would think it would be the opposite.
When you have adolescents, right, you have teenagers going back to school, and there's one school that's supposed to be serving four different communities, and in four different communities, you have eight different street gangs, and then you bring them together to school, well, there's going to be conflict, there's going to be tension there.
Is there anything else going on with the gangs that would cause them to just be more agitated right now and more prone to homicides and shootings?
You know what? Social media has a lot to do with that. If you look at some of the shootings that have taken place in the last few months, a lot of it is also attributed to social media, where people were using Facebook Live, taunting another gang about, I'm in your hood, I'm in your neighborhood, I'm doing this, doing that. And within minutes, you hear gunshots, and the person is either shot or dead. I believe that is an area that needs to be more explored.
You've talked about giving people hope. Is there something that public officials need to be doing in Chicago that they're not doing now?
The truth is that elected officials and police and nonprofit organizations and churches, they're few. They're very few compared to the larger number of people who live in these neighborhoods. If I was a person of power, if I had the resources to leverage, I think that some of the things that I would do is, if I know that shootings happen between the hours of 6 o'clock to 2 in the morning, what would it look like for several weeks to organize and coordinate churches, the suburbs, politicians, police officers, county sheriffs, you know, law enforcement, juvenile probation officers, and so on and so on, to go into these communities and just be seen? Walk around in groups. Hang out. The guys in the gangs are hanging out in the corner. Well, you know what? Hang out with them. Make them feel uncomfortable. I mean, do it in a smart, strategic way, right? Have an officer there with you, too. You know, or have somebody who has a law enforcement person. I would bring the elderly involved, right? Most gang members, majority at least, respect, you know, older people. And so what does it look like to have them there? Gang members also respect, to a great extent, clergy. What does it look like to have some of the clergy, but what does it look to actually have a coordinated effort by all the people I just mentioned right now and really take over a block?
Why do you think this has not happened?
I think you need resources to coordinate. I think you need people to really buy into that. I think a part of it is that at the end of the day, we all have our own jobs, our own like lives, our own families. And so, you know, sometimes people, it's like, more than things like, yeah, I could volunteer an hour, you know, but I can't stay there a whole night, or I can't stay there 5 hours, or I can't do this every single day or every single week. You know, one thing that I've learned in this line of work is that privilege comes in many forms and many ways. You have people who might volunteer, you know, once a week at a soup line or once a week mentoring a kid. And that's great. It's amazing. I'm so glad that's happening. And then 2 months later, they might say, you know what? I did my good deed. Time to move on to something else. And that's okay. But those things, right? The way of thinking sometimes comes from a very privileged perspective, because people want to do good. The thing is that violence, it's not a two-hour thing, right? It's an investment. It's a long-term investment. It's a coordinated effort and investment. And I think that that's been our short sight behind all that we do.
I realize that the people who live in the neighborhoods that are so racked by violence live under tremendous stress, something that I can't even imagine. Maybe you can't even imagine what it is anymore. But is there something that the people in the neighborhoods can do for themselves to make the situation better?
You know, it's funny. One time I was giving a talk and somebody just made the comment like, Eddie, why can't they just move out? And I looked at this person and I said, like, wow, this person is really talking out of privilege there. You know, it's not easy for someone just to be able to pick up and leave. And if they live in these neighborhoods, it's because they probably can't afford to live in other better neighborhoods where there's perhaps more police or less violence. And sometimes, you know, there's other factors that contribute to them not being able to move, such as family and mobility and so forth. I think that for the people who live in these neighborhoods, I want to say that a large portion of them, the majority of them, want a better life for themselves. They want to see their communities prosper. And they all have the potential to do so. The thing is that sometimes we don't know where we start. Do we start with a younger kid and the family? And then what happens to the older kids? And I think, like I mentioned earlier, is like, how do you give some of these families some hope? Especially for people who have been broken. How can I blame a kid for walking around the street with a gun when in reality the reason why he's carrying that gun is because of fear of what someone could do to that kid?
How do you then convince kids that there's another way to live? How do you talk to the parents?
I think some of the ways that we've been able to do that here is by exposing them to different elements. Take them out the neighborhood, showing something different. And then even within the neighborhood, show them what's good. Show them the strength that their communities actually have. And then you build off that. You build off their own strengths, their talents, their skills. Because many of these kids don't believe they actually have any of that, but they do. Social capital is so important. What are the scholarships? What school should I be applying to? That's what we do here at the Y.
How are you keeping up your hope?
The way that I see this is that Abner gave a lot of his time to us and to our country. Part of what keeps me going, part of what keeps our staff going, is that from this tragic incident, something good has to come out. Abner's life cannot just go in vain. And the best thing that we could do is to share his story, to take refuge in his contribution and what he was hoping to create in his neighborhood, in his community, to learn from that, to be able to carry that on. That should fuel us. That should continue to drive us to continue doing his work, because it is real. After Abner's passing, we had a handful of veterans that came to my office, knocked on our doors, rang the doorbell, and said, how do I sign up? How do I become a mentor? Right? So that's one prime example. The other example is I had my kids, and I'm talking about rough kids, kids that are like, you know, out here playing with guns. And when all this has been happening this past week, they stepped up to me and said, Eddie, we want to figure out a way, how do we help the family? We want to come together, a small group. We want to cut their grass. We want to clean their windows. We want to throw out their garbage. You know, we want to look after Abner's little brother and sister. To hear the sense of empathy coming from this group of kids that often are not seen that way. They're seen as heartless people. To me, that, for me, was the hope.
We've been talking with Eddie Bocanegra. He is the executive director of the Office for Youth Violence Prevention at the Chicago YMCA. Thank you so much, Eddie, for talking with us.
Thank you, and it's really a pleasure to share my thoughts.
I'm Judy Valente.